As we begin our lesson today, we're in the 21st lesson in the book of Judges, and I want to invite you to take your Bibles and open to chapter 10 and verse number 6. Chapter 10 and verse number 6 here in the book of Judges. Now, let me give it a little intro before we get down to that verse number 6. After the death of Abimelech, Israel's sin began to foster again against the Lord. And each new generation of Israelites began to drift further and further away from the covenant and from the commandment of the Lord, and nearer to the worship of Baal and Ashtaroth. Tola and Jared helped curb the sin in some way that is not clear to us in this entry that's in the scripture that we read in the last lesson. It's very vague at best, but no less, Israel fell into Baal worship again, and the writer tells us that sin and the entrance of the Philistines and the Ammonites who oppressed the nation of Israel for 18 years. The writer tells us of the sin of Israel here in chapter 10 and verse number 6. Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, served the Baal and the Ashtaroth, the gods of Aram, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the sons of Ammon, the gods of the Philistines. Thus they forsook the Lord and did not serve Him. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and He sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the sons of Ammon. And they afflicted and crushed the sons of Israel that year. For 18 years they afflicted all the sons of Israel who were beyond the Jordan in Gilead in the land of the Amorites. The sons of Ammon crossed the Jordan to fight also against Judah, Benjamin, and the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was greatly distressed. Now, as indicated in this passage, Israel was surrounded by Baal and Ashtaroth worshipers. Aram sat north of Israel. Sidon was northwest along the coast of Israel. So Aram's up north. Sidon is northwest, in fact, to the west of Aram, along the coast of Israel. And Sidon was there. And Moab was down southeast on the other side of the Dead Sea. And Ammon was on the east side of Israel, on the far east side of Israel's eastern border, on that east side of the Jordan River. Now, this map will help you see what I'm talking about, making it easier. Now, what did Israel do to counter this significant influence of Baal and Ashtaroth worship that had come upon them? Absolutely nothing. Enter the Philistines and the Ammonites into the picture of the bidding of the Lord to oppress Israel. As you might remember, the Philistines were descendants of Egyptian heritage. As a reminder, we've already spoken about this once, but I go back to Smith's Bible Dictionary, and it states this about the Philistines. It has been generally assumed that Kaphtor represents Crete, and that the Philistines migrated from that island either directly or through Egypt into Palestine. But the name Kaphtor is more probably identified with the Egyptian Coptics. So what's it telling us? We're not sure who these Philistines are, but we know they either come from Crete or they're either Egyptian, and more likely they are Egyptian. Now, as for the Ammonites, they were distant cousins of Israel through Abraham's nephew Lot, who had two sons, if you remember. One was named Moab, and the other was named Ammon, A-M-M-O-N. This group lived east of the tribal area of Gad, that's the Ammonites, next to the desert sands of what we call modern-day Jordan that lead to modern-day Iraq. Now, as for the Philistines, they lived on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea to the west of the area of Judah in the modern day area we call the Gaza Strip. We are unclear as to the actual year the Philistines and the Ammonites attacked and crushed Israel on the west side of the Jordan River. But no doubt, it only took 1 year for them to oppress the nation. And then, according to the passage that we just read, the same year they moved to afflict all the sons of Israel who were beyond the Jordan in Gilead in the land of the Amorites, A-M-O-R-I-T-E-S. Notice that is not Ammonites, that is Amorites. The mention of the Amorites in this verse does not mean that the Amorites were living in Gilead at the time. Instead, it means that the Israelites were living in Gilead where they were on the land that was formerly owned by the Amorites. Specifically, the land that they are on was once owned and controlled by Og, the king of the Amorites, whom Moses totally defeated, destroyed all the people, took their cities, and they took the Amorite land, and they gave it as a gift to the tribes of Gad and half the tribe of Manasseh. We must not confuse the Ammonite people with the Amorite people. That's an important point. The Ammonites were of the same heritage as Abraham and cousins to the Israelites, all being descendants of Noah's son, whose name was Shem. The Amorites, on the other hand, were a Canaanite tribe, all descendants of Noah's son, Ham, through Ham's son, Canaan. In other words, Canaan was the grandson of Noah. We've stated this many times in our study through these last few books that we've been in. And as stated here, the Amorites mentioned in this passage had been destroyed by Moses as recorded in Deuteronomy. Now, the Ammonites, Israel's cousins, were not destroyed by Moses or Joshua. And in this passage, we learn that the Ammonite cousins of Israel, in conjunction with the Philistines, got together to oppress Israel for 18 years at the Lord's bidding. The Lord sent them. Now, the Philistines were located on that west side of Israel, the west side of Judah. The Ammonites were located on the east side of Israel. So Israel was getting it from both sides. Both moved into Israel as oppressors. But the writer indicates here in this passage that the Ammonite tribe crossed the Jordan to fight also, get this, against Judah, Benjamin, and the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was greatly distressed. From south to north, Judah's boundary touches Benjamin's southern boundary. Benjamin's northern border touches Ephraim's southern border or boundary. So attacked by Ammon, the lower strong section of Israel, being Judah, Benjamin, and the lower part of Ephraim, was greatly oppressed and distressed. Now it is interesting to note before we continue that the Philistines have now become the enemies of Israel for the very first time at the beginning of this 18 years of oppression. They've not been the enemy of Israel up until this point. So they will continue from this spot in this story to be bitter enemies of Israel even to this day in our lives. When we hear about Israel and we hear about the bombings that are going on in Israel, where is it coming from? It's coming from the Gaza Strip, who are the Philistines. The sin of Israel led to 18 years of oppression, as we have stated, and that was long enough. Finally, we hear the cry of Israel in verse number 10 of chapter 10. Then the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord, saying, We have sinned against you, for indeed we have forsaken our God and served the Baals. The Lord said to the sons of Israel, Did I not deliver you from the Egyptians, the Amorites, the sons of Ammon, and the Philistines? Also, when the Sidonians, the Amalekites, and the Moabites oppressed you, you cried out to me, and I delivered you from their hands. Yet you have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore I will no longer deliver you. Go and cry out to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of your distress. And the sons of Israel said to the Lord, We have sinned. Do to us whatever seems good to you. Only please deliver us this day. So they put away the foreign gods from among them and served the Lord. And he could bear the misery of Israel no longer. Just as before in the previous four cycles of sin, the people cried out to the Lord and he gave them a lecture concerning all he had done for them and how they had rejected him. And in this case, the Lord told Israel to go beg Baal to save them from the oppression. But Israel was caught. They knew Baal could not help them. They knew they had sinned. They knew they needed the Lord. What did Israel do then? Israel cleaned up its act. How do we know that? Because it says this. They put away the foreign gods and began serving the Lord. The Lord saw their sincerity. And look what the writer says. He could bear the misery of Israel no longer. In other words, the impatience of the Lord with Israel's sin was over, and the Lord was obliged to help Israel. I like what Kiel and Dietrich's biblical commentary has to say on this. It's a commentary of the Old Testament, of this passage, and here's what it says about this phrase. In order to bend the sinner at all, the love of God must withdraw its helping hand and make men feel the consequences of their sin and rebelliousness, that they may forsake their evil ways and turn to the Lord their God. When this end has been attained, the same divine love manifests itself as pitying and helpful grace. Punishment and benefits flow from the love of God and have for their object the happiness and well-being of men. Well, after crying to the Lord, it seems that Israel took it upon itself to find a leader to bring victory against the Ammonites and the Philistines. So we see the search of Israel for a leader in verse number 17. Then the sons of Ammon were summoned, and they camped in Gilead. And the sons of Israel gathered together and camped in Mizpah. The people, the leaders of Gilead, said to one another, Who is the man who will begin to fight against the sons of Ammon? He shall become head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. Evidently, the king of Ammon, or at least his commanders and generals, had gathered all the Ammonite army in a section of the land of Gilead that has been captured by them, the Ammonites. A summons had been issued for this gathering to take place, and all the Ammonite troops were there. Learning that Ammon's troops were in Gilead, Israel followed suit and gathered its troops over in a place in Mizpah, which is also located in the land of Gilead. And it was near the Ammonite troops where they were camped. No doubt, Israel was ready to fight Ammon, but Israel needed a leader. Who is the man who will begin to fight against the sons of Ammon? They ask. Israel needed a leader. Israel needed someone to organize the battle. Israel needed someone to sound the alarm and start the battle. Israel needed someone who could win the battle. But who would that be? And as we will see next, Israel began to fight with Ammon, even though they did not have the Lord's chosen leader, the Lord's chosen judge in place. They still began to fight. Now enter Jephthah into the scene as Israel's judge. Now Jephthah, the Gileadite, was a valiant warrior, but he was the son of a harlot, and Gilead was the father of Jephthah. Gilead's wife bore him sons, and when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, "You shall not have an inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman." So Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob, and worthless fellows gathered themselves about Jephthah, and they went out with him. What does that mean? First, it means that in his life, Jephthah had proven himself to be a brave, a courageous, and a fearless soldier in military conflicts, battles. Second, if you've never looked at scholars' comments in various commentaries about this, you would never know from reading what we just read in this description that Jephthah and his heritage is highly convoluted and many disagree on how to explain it. So let me explain it for you. If we take this passage and try to understand it at its face value with only the information on this page, here is what we gather in our knowledge. Jephthah was the son of Gilead, and that made him a Gileadite because the family was large. We'll talk about that in a minute. However, Jephthah's mother was not a legal wife of Gilead. Instead, she was a harlot, or what is known today as a prostitute. In addition, Gilead's legal wife bore him more sons who were clearly in line to receive an inheritance when Gilead died. Not wanting Jephthah to share in that inheritance, the sons of the legal wife ran him off to the land of Tob, where Jephthah became the leader of a band of thugs who were well known for their war and their battles and their successes in that. Now that's simple, right? Yes. Well, no, it's not simple. And here's why. Here is where scholars take a turn with this story. And frankly, they conjure up a deeper meaning that has its roots buried many, many years in the past before Jephthah was even born. Let me say this here as a reminder. Two similar stories with similar names and similar circumstances do not mean that the two stories are the same story. Let me explain. Verse 1 says, "Now Jephthah the Gileadite." Okay, the word Gileadite means, and it tells us, that Jephthah was a descendant and a member of the tribe of Manasseh. If you remember, Joseph's son Manasseh had only one son who was named Machir. Machir had several sons. He called one of his sons Gilead. Here is where the heritage problem begins. Gilead's mother, if you will remember, was a concubine, not a legal wife of Machir. You see the similarities? So at this point in the passage, many scholars of the past have struggled with the writer's intent because the information about Gilead that is given over in the book of 1 Chronicles tells us something. And here's what it tells us. The sons of Manasseh were Asriel, whom his Aramean concubine bore. She bore Machir, the father of Gilead. Machir took a wife for Huppim and Suppim, whose sister was named Maacah. And the name of the second was Zelophehad, and Zelophehad had daughters. Maacah, the wife of Maacar, bore a son, and she named him Peresh. And the name of his brother was Sharish, and his sons were Ulam and Rakam. The son of Ulam was Bedan. These were the sons of Gilead, the son of Maacar, the son of Manasseh. That's convoluted. What does all that mean? It tells us these are the sons of Gilead, and then of Manasseh, and then it gets all the way down. It finally tells us that these are the sons of Gilead. So if Manasseh only had one son, who was this man by the name of Asriel? Some scholars say Asriel was the name of the Aramean concubine. However, that cannot be true. Asriel is the son of the concubine. It's not the name of the concubine. But is Asriel the son of Manasseh, or is Asriel the son of Maacar? Furthermore, was the Aramean concubine the mother of Maacar, Manasseh's only son? What are we to make of this obscure passage? Well, we must be thankful for the book of Numbers, because it tells us that Asriel is the son of Gilead. Here it is in the book of Numbers. Numbers chapter 26, starting with verse number 29. The sons of Manasseh of Maacar, the family of the Maacarites, and Maacar became the father of Gilead, the family of the Gileadites. These are the sons of Gilead, of Ezer, the family of the Ezerites, of Helek, the family of the Helekites, Asriel, the family of Asrielites, and Shechem, the family of Shechemites, and of Shemida, the family of the Shemidites, and of Hefer, the family of the Heferites. Now Zelophehad, the son of Hefer, had no sons, but only daughters. And the names of the daughters of Zelophehad were Mahla, Noah, Hogla, Milcab, and Tirzah. Because of the placement of the name of Zelophehad in both passages, it is clear that Asriel was the son of Gilead by an Aramean concubine. Asriel was the great-grandson of Manasseh, and in the Hebrew way of considering son, still a son of Manasseh as a great-grandson. Now that's confusing, but just bear with me. Now we come to the next problem. The Gilead mentioned as the son of Maacar had been dead far too long to be the father of Jephthah. And as such, the name Gilead must have been a common name in the Gilead family of descendants of the tribe of Manasseh. Why not? It just so happens that Jephthah's father was named Gilead, and he was the patriarch of the Gilead family in the tribe of Manasseh. So here is where similarities begin to confuse. And some scholars have long tried to mix the two stories into one. So reading on, we found out that Jephthah was the son of a harlot. A harlot is not a legal wife. So we should not confuse this word with that of a concubine. The mother was not a concubine. His mother was not. She had been a concubine of Gilead. The Hebrew word Peliska would have been used in this verse if she had been a concubine, but it wasn't. Instead, the harsh Hebrew word Zona was used, and it flatly means a harlot. So, however, sometimes Zona is used by some Israelites of a woman not of an Israelite heritage, and that makes absolute sense. Asriel's mother was a concubine not of Israelite heritage. Therefore, the writer might have used this harsh word Zonah purposefully with Jephthah because he was not a full-blood legal son of this man by the name of Gilead, just as Asriel was not a full-blown son of Maker's son whose name was Gilead. You catch what I'm saying? Maker's son was Gilead, but he's been dead way too long. Now we've got another Gilead who's had a son by the name of Jephthah. But this Gilead did not have legal sons with legal wives, for the passage says, Gilead's wife bore him sons, and when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, You shall not have an inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman. So Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob, and worthless fellows gathered themselves about Jephthah, and they went out with him. Did the legal sons of this particular Gilead have the right to run the sons of the harlot away from the family? Well, according to the law in Deuteronomy, they did. For Deuteronomy tells us this in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 2, No one of illegitimate birth shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of his descendants, even to the 10th generation, shall enter the assembly of the Lord. They did not want the Jephthah around in the land, and they made it so hard for him that he had to flee from his brothers to the land of Tob. Now, where is the land of Tob? Well, I wish I had time to tell you, but I do not. So we're going to pick up with this topic the next time we come together in the next lesson in the book of Judges.